Heavy on 90.8 FM, Radio Campus Grenoble, with English Talk Radio. My guest today is Christine Minsky, former ETR financial presenter, now resident of Paris, and their fortunes. Greetings, Christine. Welcome back to English Talk Radio.
Thanks for having me back, Vivi. It's always a pleasure.
Investors are worrying about the fall of share prices and the volatility of markets this year. So says the Times of London. Should they worry?
I wouldn't say worry. Equity markets are in a falling phase. They typically rally early in the year as institutional investors pour their money into funds. And then as shares fall, that just mathematically creates volatility. It's just a calculation. We could simplify and say volatility is like standard deviation or variance. If any ETR listeners are big into statistics, and stocks move faster on the downside than to the upside. Mm-hmm. So whenever they fall, volatility just mathematically increases. So, and even for small decreases in stock prices, volatility will go up. So should you worry? It depends on your investment horizon, I would say. If you're investing for the long term, say 10 years or more, no, and in fact, you might want to consider a buying strategy, maybe fix yourself some levels at which you'd like to buy more, and then stick to those because that's not easy to buy as stocks are falling. If your horizon is shorter, say you were saving to buy a house at the end of this year, then that's a more difficult situation. In fact, it might already be too late to catch up on that. Mm. But it is a scary thing, but we just have to remember that our instincts can push us to take irrational steps. I myself, last year, I looked at a fund in the middle of the year that had done 90% performance year to date, and I thought, what am I doing? I've got to get into this fund. And then personally, I just get busy, and so I don't actually move my investments that much, and I don't really have much either. But, you know, I don't have time to take care of it.
Right.
By the time I looked at it again,
boom,
the fund had only gone up 15%. Now, why did I want to buy it when it was up 90% and not when it was up 15%? That's contrary. So we're all biased kind of that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just have to be careful of that. So, if you're in it for long term, you're fine. And I hope you were in it for the long term, I can say.
Well, let's hope all of us have long-term money. Stagflation, is it a dirty word? Explain.
Stagflation. So stagflation is a combination of high inflation and stagnation. So stagnation is low or maybe negative economic growth, maybe a recession.
Right.
And it hasn't reared its ugly head since the late 70s and early 80s. And the reason is simple. If input prices, so like commodities, are relatively stable, then the only way there's going to be inflation is through growth. So the economy grows, unemployment drops because we need more people to contribute to production. And then as unemployment gets a little too tight, then companies have to bid up for employment. They have to increase wages. And then through wages, we get inflation.
Mm.
But in stagflation, we get inflation from the input prices rising.
Wait,
like
wait,
gas.
Christine, say that again. Say that part again.
Yes, so I was saying, so when stagflation comes,
right,
the inflation comes from the input prices.
Right,
so
right.
Gas, commodity prices increasing, energy prices increasing. And this we're all, all of our listeners will be completely familiar with this given the current political situation. So if companies can't pass on these price increases to their clients, they will slow down production. And that creates like a weakening spiral where they have to let go of employees because they're not producing enough because they just can't pass it on to all of their clients. And so it's not pleasant because, it's really the worst of both worlds. So
we want to stay away from stagflation. It is a dirty word.
It is a dirty word, yeah. And central banks don't like it because they have to fight inflation. At least the ECB has to fight inflation. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. has to fight inflation, but is also supposed to somewhat promote growth. And they're a bit more balanced in terms of a mandate. But the ECB doesn't really want to hurt the economy either. So if the ECB increases interest rates to fight inflation, they could have a further slowing down effect on the economy, but there's only so long they can wait. Now they've inflation is kind of potentially out of control. I don't really think it's out of control, but that's what the financial markets think.
Well, that's my next question. Stock markets have not hit bottom yet. Some people are grumbling and saying, well, they should. And other people are saying, no, it's not happening for a long time. What's your opinion?
Well, there's this phrase in markets where we say sell in May and go away. So it's going to be rocky from now until October. The ECB is eventually going to raise rates in July, and they've communicated that to the market. And again, I believe in September or October. So we need to see how the markets react to that. Maybe it's already priced in, but maybe not. So it's going to be rocky until the ECB moves into a rate rising mode. And then we need to see how inflation reacts to that. Will inflation finally start to calm down a bit? Or is it just, the sky's the limit, and then the central banks are like chasing inflation? And that's really not where they want to be. And the markets don't like that either, because then it looks like inflation is just out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of firms make predictions about financial markets. Is there anyone we can trust? Is there anyone sensible? I mean, we're looking for a little sanity to take us through the next few months until October. And it's spending time. I mean, especially in Europe, we're spending money on holidays and having a good time. And should we not be doing that? Who do we trust?
Who do we trust? Yeah. So in terms of prediction, yes.
Sorry, that's an innocent question.
Well, you know, it's printed on the U.S. fiat money, in God we trust, so, which is a pretty odd statement for a central bank to just say,
yes.
We don't know what we're doing,
yes.
We're going to church. Predictions. I'm not into really predictions myself. I believe it was a Dutch central banker who once said that if you're having visions, you should see a doctor.
Right.
So I don't really think predictions are necessary. And it's important to keep in mind, as individuals, you know, we're investing our own little money. You know, we see these predictions flying through the press, you know, bank such and such predicts that. Banks have to do that, and institutional investors have to crystallize their economic view and put a figure on it. You know, say we expect the CAC 40 to be at such and such level at the end of the year, but it's never going to be true. You know, it's just kind of a direction, and we don't have to take that as being, solid truth. The markets right now are quite driven by this macro data, in particular inflation. And so if you want to get a good idea of which direction inflation is going, really, there's just a lot on the central bank websites. So in Europe, you can just look at the European Central Bank website, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of England. And the central
Bank of England. You're mentioning England.
Oh. I am mentioning the Bank of England, yeah.
I didn't think we had any money in England.
You've got a lot of money. You can print it if you'd like to.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying, Christine, is the predictions, as you said, with the banks, they're saying, you know, do this, do that. We're looking at this, and we've looked at that, and this looks good for now, and blah, blah, blah. And you say, wait a minute, this is like the medical news. Chocolate is good for you. Chocolate is bad for you. Wine is good for you. Wine is bad for you. And it changes every day, every week, you know. It's the same with financial stuff. If you're not in the financial markets, which most of us are not in the financial markets, we're looking at those headlines. We're looking at those predictions.
Yeah, exactly. And you should. I think it's good to, because it gives you an idea. You know, you should also just look at the performance of your investments and remember what your horizon is. And one thing that's important to remember for a retail investor, so you can forget the visions, one thing that will really help you or hurt you over time is the fees that you pay. And and as you look at the macro predictions, you know, you can get this idea that, you know, you have this excellent strategy and you know how you're going to invest your money. But as an individual, you know, the differences in fees from one structure to the other, you know, whether you're investing through an insurance contract or through a a PEA or, you know, any of the French or just, you know, outright mutual fund shares in a mutual fund that you have held at your custodian bank, those all have a really different fee structure. And some of them can be really expensive for individuals. And that will kill you over time. I mean, it will just slowly erode your performance.
Right.
You know, 2% every year is really, you know, it's a lot. And it can be much more than 2. And then you have entrance fees and exit fees. And so, yeah, that's where it's important to be, you know, compare different providers and things like that. And I think that's, you know, maybe kind of what that central banker meant. You know, as individuals, you know, we don't have to have this grand vision. We should, you know, be careful with the fee structure, diversify, invest in a lot of different things. Mm. And, you know, to the extent that we can. And, you know, I tend to be relatively prudent, but there are, you know, there are others who, you know, take more risk. It's kind of a personal thing too. You know, we all have our personal appetite for risk.
We certainly do. You are listening to 90.8 FM, Radio Campus Grenoble. Inflation in France, 6.8% by the end of 2022, Christine. Possible?
Yeah, it's I think that's absolutely possible. Yeah, it'll depend on what the ECB, what the reaction is to the increases in interest rates, but they're going again progressively because they don't want to compromise growth too much.
Right.
And they know that as they increase interest rates to cool inflation, they're also cooling growth. So they're doing it very gradually, and they have, the ECB has another tricky point to manage, and that's the cost of debt for Italy and Spain. They have what they call fragmentation.
Yeah.
And so they also can't raise interest rates too quickly, or it becomes expensive for Italy and Spain for their countries to borrow, and their countries have a lot of sovereign debt outstanding. And then that creates political risk in Europe again, and then we're back with, you know, political parties that
political
that are anti-euro
risk?
And so on.
That's very funny right now. There's so much political risk going on. You know, it's the mad time for politics. It's summer madness. And the money is right there behind it, or actually adjacent, I would say, from all the stuff that's going on politically. Fear index, speaking of politics. Fear gauge, fear index, do they give anything away?
I think, yeah, that's the press name for the VIX, the VIX, the volatility index.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it just means that volatility is higher. So as we mentioned earlier, it's just as stock prices fall, volatility rises. So it just means it's, you know, as it reaches a high, it shows that prices have been falling recently. So it's nothing really. It was created, I want to say, in the early 2000s by the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, because some people just want to trade volatility. And so, as you know, in financial instruments, you know, they get more and more abstract. And
right.
So instead of trading a stock, you trade the price of the volatility of the underlying stock. So it's...
And they get more excited with it, too. You know,
yeah.
They build this crescendo up, don't they?
Yes, exactly. And so then it sounds like, oh, you know, there's a fear index, but it's really more, I don't really see it as fear. It's just people are selling, and so prices are going down, and volatility is just going the opposite direction. It just goes up as stock prices fall.
We are spending more for food, drink, entertainment. There are some reasons for that. There are lots of reasons for that. One of them is the hauliers. The goods are not getting to the place where we can buy them. Different situations in different countries. But as we are looking now at packets of butter for €4.50, I mean, that's pretty shocking. I mean, are we going to stop buying butter? How much is it going to cost to go out? It sounds like reminiscent of one of our old shows, but, you know, I'm asking the same questions because will that flatten out by September? Or do you go by the idea that once we have a price hike, we have to live with it?
Yeah, it's probably the latter that you mentioned. So once we have a price hike, there's this microeconomic idea that prices are sticky because it takes it takes, well, it used to be literally, you know, the reprinting of stickers when, you know, you would go into a store and each item would have the price sticker on it. Or you'd go into a restaurant and they would have printed menus and those would need to be reprinted. And that's all a little easier now, but it's still relatively sticky. But once it changes, not only does we all kind of integrate that, but then we also, and this is where the central banks are really concerned right now, we also expect prices to rise. And so no one, and so then you have, you know, companies trying to get ahead of that and saying, well, I'm just going to increase prices 30% just because I can and because people will probably keep buying because everyone knows this is an inflationary environment. And, you know, what does it matter to them if I increase from 1 euro to 1 euro and 30? It's just 30 cents, but it's a 30% increase.
So that 4.5 euro packet of butter is probably going to still sell?
It's unless you get, you know, and then the, so the downside adjustment wouldn't be like the gradual to 4.5, from 4.5 euros to 4.45. It would be, you know, they have too much butter recurrent for over 6 months. And then suddenly they say, maybe we priced the butter a little too high. That's really expensive butter.
It's astonishing. You know, part of my real work is to look at prices and see what people are spending their money on. And so I have a few things that I watch. And one of the things is butter. And it's incredible. Of course, I chose a high price butter because I figured that would be the one that would be volatile, not the cheaper ones. And I watched this butter and it's gone up now to, as I said, 4.5 euros for a packet of butter. I mean, you've got to love your butter to spend that much money on it. Okay, so you think we do have to live with the price hike, that once that butter goes up, or that sofa, or that car, or that shirt, it's not going to come down?
No, not unless they really get it wrong. I mean, the company will have to really... yeah, get it wrong and they'd be stuck with a large inventory of, you know, unsold shirts. And then you'll see, you know, sales, or you'll see or you'll see outlet, more stock going to the outlet centers, or the butter will just disappear. And, you know, 6 months from now, they'll try to sell it at a cheaper price. But I feel like a lot of, and I see it too, a lot of merchants are just, they're just trying it. Because we're in this mode of increasing inflation expectations.
Well, and also we've had a situation, I'm coming to that with my next question, where volatility has been the word. Up and down, shops had to close, shops had to open, shops couldn't open again, and there was such an excess of goods in certain places. But we didn't get them, the consumer. I speak as a consumer. We didn't get those things. And there was this mystery of, you know, the things taken away. And you reminded me that's what they do. They take things off the market and they put them in a warehouse somewhere and they bring them back in 3 months or 6 months and try again. Because that's the only way they can make money on it.
Yeah. And to that point, there were some excellent sales, I have to say, last summer.
On butter?
Not on butter, but, you know, it obviously needs to be non-perishable, but clothing that couldn't be sold in fall 2020 due to COVID, couldn't be sold in spring 2021 due to COVID, and then it came onto sale in summer 2021. I mean, things at, you know, 75, 80% off. So,
World Affairs. Let's go to World Affairs, because you know how worldly we are on English Talk Radio. World Affairs have not helped the financial situation in most quarters. I'm thinking of the war in Ukraine, COVID in China. Anything to learn here?
So Ukraine was pretty terrifying at first. I'm not even talking about the geopolitical implications and the end of the post-Berlin Wall era, because that's not the main focus of this show, and we could go on about that a lot. But just for the financial markets, you know, it's when something, you know, large like that hits, you worry, you know, where does this end? You know, is it contained to Russia and Ukraine, or where is this, what sectors will this impact? What how bad will this get? And so, yeah, it's definitely had a an impact, but it but I have to say it's been more. It's been, I think maybe we're feeling it more as individuals through commodity prices and supply chain disruption, and the supply chain disruption is from China and the COVID closures too. So there's a lot of building materials, for example, somewhat in Europe, but to a, quite a pronounced extent in the U.S., where you know they can't get building materials fast enough to build the houses that the people would like to buy quickly before interest rates rise too much, which they have to compensate for inflation. So they're in a bit of a bind in a lot of areas. So it's no, it hasn't been helpful. I would say it's maybe a slight positive that Ukraine-Russia for now seems to be mostly contained to Ukraine-Russia and hasn't spilled out into, you know, multiple sectors and created, you know, a massive wave of defaults or anything to that extent. So that there was some concern that, you know, that they it would hit banks very hard, and in fact it didn't, and with you know, just a few exceptions, so.
Well, of course, we're talking about things like this and China and COVID, which has been very dramatic. We have to talk about the black market, because there's always a black market. Secondhand tanks, anybody? All of this kind of thing. People are making money off drama. They always do, they always have, and they always will. Agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Someone is making money from it. In fact, even from COVID, you know, there was in the U.S. there were various support measures, and there was I believe there's an estimated, I think it was 15% fraud on the aid to companies, but it just it needed to move so fast, and I think it was a political decision to not be too picky about the, you know, meeting the requirements, because they wanted to inject the aid quickly to avoid like a Great Depression type scenario.
So I get to my favorite question. I always have a favorite question. Is Bitcoin just a scam? Asked the Sunday Times. Your view from Paris.
Bitcoin. So Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, they behave like something between Forex and a commodity. They're highly volatile, and unlike Forex and commodities, they're opaque, and your bank can't participate in them yet. So Bitcoin, is Bitcoin a scam? It's a wave, I would say. If you have the stomach for surfing, then go for it. It just works like, you know, the more demand there is for it, the more it's worth. And if people sell it, then it's worth nothing. There's no intrinsic value behind it. There's no company that will pay you a dividend. There's no, you know, if you buy a house and its value goes down, you could still live in it. You could fix it up. You could repurpose it. There's no intrinsic value on Bitcoin. It's just a thing that, you know, a fixed number of Bitcoins, and people bid for it, and that's it. I personally don't have the stomach for it, but I have a friend who's very bullish on crypto, and I'm told that by this friend that in crypto investing, you are allowed to participate in what's called the asset lending part of it. Now, without getting too deep into the weeds for this, when you would typically buy like a mutual fund, say a stock fund, and those stocks are actually lent out by the asset manager, and they receive a little money for that.
Yeah, but lending. It's a little money. It's not a lot, is it?
It's not a lot. But in crypto, apparently, you can participate in that as an individual. And this friend of mine finds that you know, interesting, and something that she sees as a is worthwhile in it.
Well, are you saying you could be a middle person in this? You could make money that way?
No, I wouldn't say you'd make money, but it's one plus side of it. My take on crypto is that it's not for the faint of heart, and I'm too conservative of an investor, and I'm watching to see the day when banks can participate in it. Banks cannot participate in crypto right now. And they're prohibited from doing so, and that could change in the U.S. fairly quickly. There's some key regulatory rules that are empty, right, but they're working on filling those. And when those get filled, regulating crypto is part of that. The central banks are also moving to launch their own digital currencies. And depending on how they do that, China already has one, by the way, but the ECB and the U.S. Federal Reserve are working on theirs as well, because there seems to be this demand for almost, you know, real-time payment and something that's very secured with like a token-type mechanism end-to-end. So they're working on it. It'll change. It's a bit too opaque and too volatile for my personal...
That is not going away.
It's not going away, no. And there's and I think that's why the central banks are addressing it, because they know that if we continue as is, I mean, that portion of money that's outside the financial system will just grow. And so banks need to either get into it, or it needs to get regulated, or something has to happen.
Well, it seems I should follow the French. Money under the mattress and bitcoins in the freezer?
That sounds good, yes.
Give us some sober but good news for the coming months. Something to cheer and encourage us. Is there anything on the horizon? Do you see anything that looks good that you can say, oh, by October, November, we'll be smiling about our money?
One positive aspect right now is that the unemployment figures are still fairly low in most OECD countries, and this is ultimately quite positive, because it means that people are still consuming, and if unemployment rises due to inflation, as we mentioned, then that'll be not so good. But so far it's good, and the forecasts are still, you know, for it to increase a bit, but the forecasts aren't too bad on that. Forecasts, as we said earlier, being what they are, you know. But so unemployment isn't too bad. The other relatively positive aspect that we mentioned is Ukraine, Russia, at least from a financial perspective, the impact seems to be relatively contained at this stage. And you could also take a more cynical view then and say, what investments benefit from the current context. So look into things like defense stocks, utilities companies benefiting from rising gas and electricity prices, although Macron made a little comment about that yesterday and said that they're sharing the spoils of war, and that's not ethical, but I don't know if he'll get his way anymore. Banks, if the economy has kind of a soft landing, banks will benefit from rising interest rates. So that could be another idea. So there are some little
nuggets in there.
Yeah, some little nuggets.
Thanks, Christine. We need to pay attention to our money this summer if we are to have any left in the autumn. Happy holidays, and thanks for being a guest on English Talk Radio. Goodbye.
Thank you for having me. Thank you,
Vivi. Bye, Christine. I was talking to Christine Minsky, former financial presenter on English Talk Radio. You can listen to English Talk Radio on Wednesday, 1900, Sunday, 12:30. And don't forget the podcast, www.campusgrenoble.org. Thanks to Bertrand, English Talk Radio.